Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Kamara-Sami. We begin today in Ukraine, where millions of people have spent the day without power after a massive Russian attack on the country's energy infrastructure. According to the Ukrainian military, there are a total of 188 strikes overnight. A combination of drones and cruise and ballistic missiles were responsible. It's been another pummeling for a power grid that's taken blow after blow ever since Russia's full-scale invasion began nearly 3 years ago. Speaking in Kazakhstan, President Vladimir Putin threatened to target what he called decision-making centres in Kyiv with a new ballistic missile called Oreshnik, and he characterised the overnight bombardment as a response to Ukraine striking Russian territory with Western-supplied long-range missiles.
Last night, we carried out a comprehensive strike using 90 missiles and 100 drones. These strikes on our part also took place in response to the ongoing strikes on Russian territory by American ATACMS missiles. As I have said many times, there will always be a response from our side.
In Ukraine, President Zelensky used his nightly address to accuse President Putin of stepping up military actions, not just to cause maximum hardship to the Ukrainian people, but to undercut US President-elect Donald Trump's peacemaking plans.
Today in Kazakhstan, Putin once again promoted his missiles, his readiness to kill and destroy. To the thousands of missiles that have already hit Ukraine, Putin apparently wants to add thousands more. He does not need this war to end. Moreover, Putin wants to prevent others from ending this war.
Well, that is the political reaction. For the human impact of this latest attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, I've been speaking to two women, both in their 30s, both with children and both running businesses from Kyiv. Alina Ocheretiana owns the fashion brand Kasharovska, and Lily Marozova owns a restaurant in the Ukrainian capital. I asked Alina how today's blackouts had affected her.
Today we worked only half a day at office, as the heating in the office depends on the electricity. And when it's electricity cuts, so the office works on EcoFlow battery, and it works only for 4 hours. Today it's much longer, no electricity. And also our factory, where 100 employees work, it didn't work till 11. 11 we got electricity, and we got it till 4, so almost full half a day all the factory was working. Personally, as for me, today it feels a bit easier than, for example, 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I was really depressed in the same circumstances. I remember I cried almost every day, and it was really hard. Now we are much better prepared because of independent sources of electricity, as for homes, as for businesses. I don't know. I think that, for example, our electricians in the country, they are magicians, because they fix everything so fast that, for example, tomorrow the situation will be better. The next day it will be better and better till we have more or less full electricity power in the country.
A positive message then, Alina. What about you, Lilia? How's today been for you?
The working day actually starting from the sleepless night. All our employees doesn't sleep well. It's all the time air alarms. You have to check all the time where the rockets is, where the drones is. And till the 8 a.m. it still was air alarm. You cannot move to work. All the public transport doesn't work while it's air alarm. We open our door at 9 because everyone want to get like hot coffee, hot meal, just to get breakfast and start your day as you do it before. So employees late because of this situation, but still someone left at the restaurant to sleep.
It sounds like you feel almost you had a responsibility to others who rely
yes,
on
yes,
you.
Yes, yes, because the restaurant, it's not just about the food or something. It's right now, the restaurant is almost like a shelter in Ukraine. It's the place where you can take your hot food, you can recharge your power bank, your phone. Also, even if parents come to us and ask, can you give us please hot water to make formula for the newborns? We have to help people whatever we can do for them.
Have you got used to this situation in the way that Alina said she has?
I agree with Alina. We well prepared for this situation. It's not like last winter or the winter before. At this summer, we bought a more powerful generator. You have to all the time keep in touch the situation with the gas. It have to be recharged all the time. It keeps with us like additional payments for this, but still.
And what about home life? How has that been affected?
Home life, I have a little son. He's 7 years old. His school beginning at 9. It was also sleepless night. We live at the 21st floor. And it's so high, and we scare about this, and we run to the parking all the night, like back and up all the time. We're sitting at the, actually we're sleeping in the car. We have blanket over there, pillows, and my small son sleep there. And then we woke up, return at home. We don't have electricity, so he doesn't have a breakfast. Just went to the school, and there they have food.
When you said you returned to your home, you're on the 21st floor,
said. Yes, yes. After
you had to take the stairs, I assume.
Yes, by the stairs for the 21st floor. And we don't have water at this high. We don't have electricity on this time. At my apartment, the electricity was 2 hours today. That's it.
How do you feel about that?
I feel about it. It's not the worst situation that can be. I all the time thinking about the soldier that at the border, they outside, they cold, they scared all the time. So I'm happy that I can be at my home. It's not easy. I want to cry all the time, but I can't. I have a lot of employees. I have business. I have my family. I have to be strict for this situation.
Alina, do you see an end to this in the near future?
Of course. I believe from the first seconds they entered the territory of Ukraine on the 24th of February, they lost the same second. They are losers. And it's just a matter of time. That's it. They are huge losers.
Do you think Donald Trump coming to power in America is going to make a difference? You will, I'm sure, be aware he says he can end the war in 24 hours.
He's a tricky guy. I mean, no one can predict. I don't believe in a fairy tale that he will come to his president's chair and everything is finished. It's impossible.
Would you, as a Ukrainian, I'm going to put this to both of you, would you be prepared to give up the territory that Russia has seized if it meant peace?
For me, it's even not a question of the territories, but it's the question of responsibility.
Lilia, can I ask you what you think?
Actually, I'm completely agree with Alina because Donald Trump is quite a tricky guy, but also he's the businessman. And I heard that he can be interested of some business profits from Ukraine because it's very rich earth. I mean, metal, titan and everything that we have here. Maybe he will find some business way to resolve this situation. But it's a question of justice.
Thoughts about one businessman from two Ukrainian businesswomen, Lily Marozova and Alina Ocheretiana. Well, Russia's been involved in fighting in another country today. Its warplanes have taken part in an operation in northern Syria, where there has been fighting between government forces and rebels, the fiercest of its kind in many years. Lina Khatib is an associate fellow with the Middle East and North Africa programme at the Chatham House Policy Institute in London. I asked her about the context of this fighting, since most listeners might have assumed the civil war in Syria was over.
Well, it was never over. Actually, the area in the northwest where this fighting is taking place has been subjected to increased bombing by the Assad regime and Russia in the last 3 months. The bombing, frankly, has, you know, been taking place since the early days of the conflict, but it had intensified recently, and this is one of the reasons why we're seeing this escalation now by the rebel groups.
And who are those rebel groups?
The area in the northwest is dominated by a group called HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in Arabic. It's a group that started life as an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, then it declared that it had severed ties with Al-Qaeda, rebranded. It used to be called Nusra Front, now it's called HTS, and it has allies backed by Turkey and other rebel groups, mostly Islamist in nature, but not exclusively. But HTS is by far the most dominant group in that region, and it is the one that is leading this offensive.
And how much of a challenge does this pose for President Assad?
What is happening in the northwest is that there was an area considered a de facto buffer zone between areas where HTS is in control and areas where the Assad regime is in control. And what is happening now is an offensive by HTS and its allies to take areas back from this buffer zone, to put them under the control of HTS and its allies. And so they are edging eastwards. And this, of course, is done because they perceive Assad to be weak right now. And also they are taking advantage, these rebel groups, of the weakening of Iran in the region in general, because the Assad regime has been reliant on Iran and Russia for military and political survival. And so, of course, this is not going to be good news for Assad, who had practically taken for granted that the situation in Syria had reached a stalemate.
Yes, on Russia, how dependent now is he on that support?
Very dependent. I mean, without Russia, even with Iranian support, the Assad regime would not have managed to stay there in power until today. 2015 is the year when Russia began intervening. And I would say Russia today is the most influential foreign actor in Syria. And this, to a large degree, explains why in the broader context of the war in the Middle East right now, with Gaza and Lebanon being fronts, Syria was not really a front in which Assad forces joined kind of the war in support of the other groups. And that's because Russia does not want that.
That's Lina Khatib, Associate Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa Programme at the Chatham House Policy Institute in London, on that flare-up of fighting in northern Syria. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. Coming up later on in the programme, is Hamas ready to accept a ceasefire deal with Israel? We'll hear from one of its representatives.
We are ready to implement the broker deal, and the Qataris and the Egyptians know this. The only one who is sabotaging each time we were near to reach a ceasefire agreement was Benjamin Netanyahu.
Our main headlines at this hour. President Putin has claimed that the massive bombardment of Ukraine's power grid is in response to Kiev's recent use of Western-made weapons to strike Russia. There is heavy fighting in northwestern Syria as Islamist rebels conduct their biggest offensive against government forces in years. Thousands of Georgians are protesting after the government halted the country's EU accession plans, and more than 100 people are missing following a landslide in eastern Uganda. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. It is Thanksgiving Day in America, a day when many Americans fly home. And for three Americans, this year's reunion with their families will have a special meaning. Mark Swidan, Kai Lee and John Leung have all spent years in Chinese prisons for different reasons, but they've now been released in a single prisoner swap that was made public by the US and Chinese governments on Wednesday. Peter Humphrey is an advocate for people detained in China. He's a former prisoner there himself, and he's been working closely with the families of two of the three freed men, trying to secure their release. I asked him how unusual it is for to have a swap of this nature.
It is unprecedented that there should be a swap on this scale of this nature. It is completely unprecedented that America repatriates Chinese spies, because two of the Chinese who have been repatriated are, in fact, convicted spies. And it is unusual that there is also a fugitive among the, at least one, among those who've been repatriated. That this is also unprecedented, in my opinion, and very questionably legally. You know, if you send fugitives back to China, there's a high risk that they will not have a fair trial. There's a high risk that they will be inhumanely treated, and they face the risk of execution. So you should not be repatriating fugitives as part of such a deal. It's probably illegal to bypass the public extradition formalities.
What do you think unlocked this?
The families involved have put up a lot of efforts, campaigning and lobbying. I helped a little bit with two of them. And in September this year, we achieved something which I had been lobbying for two or three years, which was to hold a congressional hearing in Washington, D.C. on the subject of American prisoners unlawfully held in China. And I think that our hearing was very impactful. I managed to bring representatives of three families to sit with me on this witness panel for the hearing. And each one of them presented extremely compelling, dramatic story of their own situation and their loved one who's locked up in China. And it ended with the two co-chairs of this Executive Commission on China in Congress, who sent a letter to Biden demanding that he devote much of his final time in office to solving this problem and bringing Americans home. I really do think that this hearing had a big impact. It was a powerful impact. And it was not pressure just on the American government, but pressure on the Chinese government too. And for Biden in particular, because these are the waning days of his presidency, and there's a lot of controversy over what his legacy is and will be, how much of it was success and how much of it was failure, especially in foreign policy areas. So getting something done with the prisoners in China, you know, is potentially something that puts a bit of a gloss on the final months of his presidency.
These are not the only Americans being held in China, is that right?
Yes, and in the case of America, these prisoners represent not much more than 1% of all American prisoners held in China at the moment. And my own research suggests the number is probably closer to 300. And the other 290 or whatever there is are still there. And their families are all asking, well, when will it be our turn?
Well, let's turn then to the next president. What can they hope for, do you think, from a Trump administration?
We can anticipate that Trump will take a pretty hard line in his interactions with China. And that will probably include the issue of American prisoners held there. So I don't think Trump is likely to let this issue go. And I think he's likely to reverse the change in the travel advisory, which was part of this deal. The White House has basically lowered the grade of travel warning to Americans, which advised them to stay away from China. And now they seem to be saying, oh, China has suddenly become a bit safer, so we're lowering that warning. That was, you know, a giveaway to China, which China had been asking for many months as part of a quid pro quo to get this deal done. I don't think Trump will like that at all. I think it's highly likely that he will re-raise the travel warning when he enters office.
Can I just ask you finally, Peter, your own experience being imprisoned in China, what impact has it had on your efforts to help others who are detained there?
My own experience of 2 years in Xi Jinping's jails and the harsh, cruel conditions of torture which exist in those facilities was something that turned me into a more compassionate man, actually wanting to take direct action on my compassionate instincts. And so for the last 7 years, you know, I have tried to help some of the prisoners I left behind in the facilities where I was, but also many new cases where people came to me because they'd heard my story. So I've been sharing my experience to try and help them.
Peter Humphrey, former prisoner in China, now an advocate for people still detained there. A new international airport has opened in the capital of Greenland, Nuuk. Larger aircraft can now land in this vast and remote Arctic territory for the first time, making it more accessible than ever. It is the first of three airport projects that officials hope will boost Greenland's economy by helping it to diversify from fishing into tourism. Adrian Murray reports.
Rock has been blasted and tarmac laid to get this longer runway ready. And the finishing touches have been put to a brand new terminal. Until now, only small propeller planes could land in the country's biggest city.
Much larger aircraft will be able to arrive here in Nuuk, and that will pave the way for new connections to Greenland's capital.
Many locals welcome the change.
It is not only an airport for me, it is also an airport for a modern Greenland.
Lately we have been shut from the whole world, and now we're going to open for the world.
Only 4 hours' flight from either Europe or East Coast USA, Nuuk will become Greenland's travel hub. Greenland is a vast territory with a population of just 57,000 people. But until now, a remote runway built by the Americans during World War II has been the main entry point. Travellers then have to transit to their destination in small turboprop planes. And that's often been time-consuming, young Greenlander Isaac Finn tells me.
First have to fly over there, and then you have to wait, and then there's like bad weather or not enough planes, and then you get stuck there. It's annoying.
After Nuuk, two more new airports will open in 2026 as part of a plan to boost the economy. More than £640 million has been spent. Jens Lauritsen is the CEO of Greenland Airports.
It will be the key to opening up Greenland to make it easy accessible from Europe or North America. Once you make a country that has been quite difficult to get to and you create an easy access like this, I'm sure we will see a lot of tourism, we will see a lot of change.
Greenland is already seeing a small tourism boom and visitors came in record numbers last year. However, hotel accommodation is still limited.
And this is the first cabin.
The owners at Inuk Hostels have recently invested, adding luxury glass igloos. Marin Louisa Poulsen Christensen is a co-owner and the manager.
We are preparing by making new tours. Many local people got their own boats as well. Of course, we need more accommodation here. We also need more local guides and local workers.
Now, though, it's the public sector and fishing that drives Greenland's economy. Inside a waterfront factory owned by Polar Seafoods, a huge catch of prawns is being steamed, shelled and frozen, ready for export by container ship. The company's chair, Michael Binzer, hopes that shorter direct flights will open up new business possibilities.
I think the biggest change is going to that we look into more fresh seafood. It will cut down the transportation by maybe a full day, which is a lot.
This new infrastructure is meant to be a shot in the arm for Greenland's economy. Its impact could be far-reaching.
And that was Adrian Murray reporting from Greenland. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. The people of Ireland go to the polls on Friday. The general election is expected to be a tight race between the three main parties, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin. In recent years, Ireland has generated huge revenues from big multinational corporations, but despite the country's wealth, young people in particular are struggling. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page reports.
Buskers build up a decent pile of cash in Grafton Street in Dublin. But it's the public purse that's really swelling in this country. Ireland is pulling in a massive tax take from multinational corporations, which have bases here. This year, the state's income is set to be £21 billion more than its basic outgoings. But of course, that's triggering more debates about how the economy's playing out in people's lives.
It's not really feasible for me to look for accommodation. And I work two jobs as well, and nothing is coming up within my budget.
Lucy Byrne is a theoretical physics student at Trinity College, but she commutes almost 4 hours a day from her family home because she can't afford to live in the city.
I'm planning on finishing the degree here and then doing my master's and my PhD abroad.
The median age in Ireland is 39, the second youngest in the EU. Dublin's one of the most expensive cities in Europe to rent accommodation, and the cost of buying a home in this nation has roughly doubled in a decade.
I'm 25, I'm a teacher, and I'm still living at home at the minute. I'm in a civil servant job, which is meant to be one of the most stable jobs in the country, and I can't afford to even move out of my own family home to rent, never mind actually buy a house.
Housing and the cost of living are two of the main issues in the election. The flush government finances mean most parties are making huge spending promises, pledging to invest billions in subsidised childcare, infrastructure and public services. But potential economic pressures are also being discussed, especially whether any change in policy in Washington under Donald Trump might lead American corporations to move more business away from here and back to the US.
We've gone from having 7 employees to close to 90 at the moment.
Daniel McLaughlin is 35 and owns the Rocksalt Cafe in Dundalk. He started his business after moving back to Ireland from abroad. For him, recent times have been positive.
Overall, we're in a stable place, you know, business is good.
So what would you want the next government, whoever that may be, to do for business people like yourself?
I'd love to just see a little bit more support for businesses and entrepreneurs to just release some of that restraint and try and continue to grow the economy.
Whoever wins power in Dublin will have a challenge many other governments might envy: how to best manage and protect a big budget surplus. It's the pivot point which will set Ireland's direction for the rest of the 2020s.
And that report from the Irish capital was by the BBC's Chris Page. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. It is a crisis of staggering proportions which demands the world's urgent attention. Those words were used by the new United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator, not to describe Gaza or Lebanon or Ukraine, but the situation in Sudan in northeast Africa. It's a country that's been ravaged by famine, horrific violence and sexual abuse as the National Army and the militia known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, wrestle for control. Half of its population of 50 million needs life-saving aid, and it's not getting enough attention, in part because it's very hard and dangerous for journalists to report from there. But our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has travelled to Sudan with the UN's new relief chief, Tom Fletcher, and she sent this report.
We'll be landing in Port Sudan at 25.
What's on your mind, your first trip?
This is my first mission. We're getting into Sudan. I really worry that this has become in some ways an invisible crisis. And it's not invisible to us. It's not invisible to our humanitarian movement, but it's not cutting through in the media and in political life. And so I hope the visit can also shine a light on what's going on and the situation people are facing.
Is that why you take on this job at a time when the world is confronted by so many crises of unprecedented proportions, which you chose Sudan?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the biggest crisis that we face, so it's right to be there.
That's the sound of toy blocks on a bare floor in this crumbling school. It's a shelter now for orphans. More children are on the run in Sudan than anywhere else in the world. Nearly 5 million. One of them, 13-year-old Mahmoud. What do you miss about your home in Khartoum?
Basketball, bicycle, pizza.
Pizza?
I'm a consultant for alternative family care.
Tell us about Mahmoud's story.
He was adopted when he was 10 months old.
In Khartoum, the capital.
In Khartoum, the capital. And then when the war broke in Khartoum, he was evacuated with other children to Medini. Then from Medini, transferred here to Kassala.
When you see this boy, with such an innocent face, a big smile. He's lost all his front teeth. What goes through your mind? How is he suffering?
It's a great suffer for a child in his age. But what we are trying to do is to place all these children into loving family life again.
Mahmoud, what is your dream now?
I would like to be a state governor. I'll fix the situation of the country. Then I will build houses.
Sexual violence is being used as a weapon of war in Sudan. Our service providers have reported breaking stories. This suffering must end now. And we all
dozens of women sitting on plastic chairs under a canopy in the baking heat, all of them displaced by this war. Just a snapshot of what is happening across Sudan. Violence against women and girls, it's a major crisis.
My name is Rumaysa Abdel Munim Musa. I'm 23 years old.
This event today was about sexual violence as a weapon in war. Is that something the women here worry about, fear? Has it happened to women that you know?
Yes, definitely. It's something that we feel a lot fear of it. When I was, my personal experience, when I was in Khartoum, even me and my mom and my aunts, we could not get out because I was afraid to get attacked by those soldiers.
You were afraid you would be kidnapped, taken away?
Those people were very dangerous, so we cannot even take the risk to get any contact with them. They don't respect women. They get they harass women, not just women, women and men.
In a war-torn country of so much suffering, listen to these laborers sweating in the heat, trying to keep their spirits up. We're in a vast warehouse of the United Nations World Food Programme. And you can hear the men carting boxes one after the other on their shoulders to the trucks waiting outside to take them to the worst affected areas of this crisis. In the middle of the war, a war just to feed people.
Hi, my name is Alex Marinelli. I'm the head of operations at the World Food Programme here in Port Sudan. We're currently in the warehouse watching specialised nutritious food being loaded by a very lively gang of labourers. We're trying to drive thousands of kilometres across a conflict. So we have to cross multiple lines of control, hundreds of various checkpoints. So the journey of moving trucks full of food across Sudan is fraught with danger, is fraught with physical difficulties, and a lot of negotiations, engagements at all levels are needed to make sure that this vital humanitarian aid finds free passage to the people that need it.
Alex, you've worked in so many places around the world confronting a crisis of hunger. How does this compare?
By far, this is the worst humanitarian situation I've ever seen or had to face. I've been working for the World Food Programme for more than 25 years. I've served in so many countries in emergencies. I have never seen anything like it.
That was Alex Marinelli, the head of operations for the World Food Programme in Port Sudan, ending that report by Lise Doucette. On Friday, a man will eat a banana, but not just any banana.
At $5 million for the banana, here it is. These are words I never thought I'd say. $5 million for a banana. Don't let it slip away.
Well, that was the moment last week when the Chinese-born cryptocurrency entrepreneur Justin Sun bought a banana duct taped to a wall for a total, including fees, of $6.2 million. The banana, the centrepiece of an artwork entitled Comedian, has to be replaced every few days, hence its new owner's decision to complement a piece of conceptual art with a performance. Now, it's fair to say Comedian has divided opinion in the art world even before it was bought for such an eye-watering sum of money. As the founder of the cryptocurrency platform Tron, Justin Sun has already invested in NFTs, non-fungible tokens, digital assets or tokens that can be bought or sold, as well as intangible paintings by the likes of Picasso and Andy Warhol. He has also fallen foul of the US Securities and Exchange Commission, which has sued him for allegedly using fraudulent means to raise the price of his cryptocurrency. This week, he was named as an advisor to Donald Trump's crypto venture World Liberty Financial, days after his company invested $30 million in it. Well, before that announcement, I spoke to Justin Sun and I asked him why he had decided to spend $6 million on a banana duct taped to a wall.
It's not only a banana, right? It's conceptual arts. Since I have been in the cryptocurrency and the blockchain industry, I start to understand like the value actually come from like everybody's consensus rather than only the banana itself. Just like Bitcoin, right? When I get into the Bitcoin industry in 2012, Bitcoin is less than $1. And after like 12 years development, Bitcoin now is worth like 100K. The difference is like more people is know about Bitcoin, excited about Bitcoin. I think that's like why the Bitcoin price goes up. I think the banana duct tape to the wall is the similar concept here.
When you say that this work of art, the conceptual art, is part of this broader movement, if we can call it that, involving blockchain and cryptocurrency, how do you see the two then coming together?
When I first learned about this conceptual art concept, I always ask a question, right? So if I purchase a banana duct tape to the wall, can I get a banana? Can I get duct tape? You know, and how can I like display it on the wall? Because I also collect, you know, Giacometti, Picasso, like before, all those traditional artwork, I get a physical piece, right? It's going to deliver to my house, you know, I can see the artwork, I will have insurance on the artwork. But this is the first time, it's just like NFT, you know, cryptocurrency, NFT. When you get those artworks, you don't have the physical piece, right? It's just a concept and store it on the internet.
Now, the work is called Comedian. Is the joke on us? Is the joke on you paying so much money for it?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. Even for myself, I firmly believe the price will go up in the next 10 years. But we don't know, and we can revisit it after 10 years.
Well, what about in the next 4 years when Donald Trump is in office? Because clearly he's someone who's taken to cryptocurrency of late. And you've announced that you've invested $30 million into his crypto project, World Liberty Financial. Do you think that him coming to power again is going to make a huge difference to the value of your piece?
Yes, I want to deliver this banana duct tape to the wall, to the White House. I think he will love the idea because, you know, I think he always challenges the norms as well. I have high confidence he might do it in the White House. And also, of course, I think Donald Trump be the president-elect, like really boost our industry to regulate cryptocurrency in a better way.
Now, I have to ask you about the legal battle you have had or are still having with the US Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. It's accused you of fraudulently inflating the trading volumes of TRX, a crypto token your company Tron has. You've denied those charges. What would you say to those who say that by making this purchase and in talking about it so publicly, this is distracting or an attempt to distract from that ongoing legal case?
I think after Gary Gensler, you know, resigned from SEC, which I publicly offer him a job on my ex post, I think this case will be resolved very soon.
And just a final thought then on the banana, people who will say, perhaps people who are skeptical of performance art, conceptual art in general, and think that this is simply throwing money down the drain. What do you say to them?
First of all, I think we need to give some tolerance to the new idea, right? No matter in arts, you know, in technology development. When I first find out like Bitcoin, like 12 years ago, it's also a very challenging like idea. Actually, you know, Bitcoin is also the first time in the world when you have money, right? It's not like a physical coins or paper. It's actually some like code on the internet. It's defined as a money, right? It's also kind of like challenge the concept of the money here. So I think the banana duct to the wall Comedian, it's the first time actually challenge the traditional concept of the value of the art and also even the concept of the art in the first place. I think we need to give it some time to see how it plays out, and it might succeed in the future.
Food for thought, food for art as well. Crypto entrepreneur and art collector Justin Sun. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kumarasamy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kumarasamy. Israel has imposed a curfew on southern Lebanon for a second night as the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah remains nervously in place, despite accusations from both sides of violations. Well, on yesterday's programme, the US Middle East envoy Amos Hochstein told us he hoped that the Lebanon ceasefire could open the door to something similar in Gaza. So far, no sign of that, although there is considerable pressure from within Israel for a Gaza deal to be struck, most acutely from the relatives of the 101 hostages who remain in the Gaza Strip, of whom 50 to 60 are thought to still be alive. Moshe Emilio Lavi's brother-in-law, Omri Miran, is one of them.
We just saw that the government approved a ceasefire in Lebanon with Hezbollah, even though in that case there are no hostages there, but in the case of Gaza, they continue to refuse to do so. The many families of hostages believe that they insist not to sign that deal because there are interests that are not relevant to the legitimate security and diplomatic considerations.
Well, for the view from inside Gaza, I've been speaking to Farida Adel. She's a Palestinian teacher who has been frequently displaced since the war began. Struggling with a poor phone signal, she told me about the current conditions there.
To be honest, I'm so speechless. I can't find real word can describe what's going on now in Gaza City for my people, specific those people in the south and those people in the north. Current situation reflects a harsh reality, and people here face a lot of humanitarian suffering. Residents here face a daily struggle with severe shortages of clean water, electricity, and basic necessities. Can you imagine no basic necessities such as bread or water or something like that? Also, the hospitals are struggling.
Do you think that the ceasefire in Lebanon could have any impact on your life? Could it make any difference further down the line? Could it change the situation in any way?
To be honest, we are so happy for them because we don't need more bloody zones in this war. Okay, but we are here from Gaza. We are so hopeless because the people around the world treat Gazans not as a human. We don't have any right of a human. I have some drones around my home. Maybe this is the last message that coming from Gaza.
That was Farida Adel, a Palestinian teacher, speaking to me from the Gaza Strip. Well, for the view from Hamas itself, we turn to one of its senior officials, Bassem Naim. Just a reminder, Hamas is considered a terrorist organization, not just by Israel, but by many Western governments. Bassem Naim is currently based in Istanbul, and it's from there he spoke to NewsHour's Tim Franks. Tim put it to him that more than 13 months into the war in Gaza, Hamas is now more alone than ever before.
The main goal of our struggle in Palestine is how to achieve our national goals, independence, self-sovereignty, and independent state, and so on. That some parties are supporting us, this is, yes, welcomed. And any absence of any of these kind of support, it could affect the front in Gaza or in the West Bank or in Jerusalem. But at the end, it doesn't solve the problem inside Palestine, the occupation.
You say that it's not related, but it is pretty certain, isn't it, that when Yahya Sinwar, the former leader of Hamas, organised the attacks on Israel in October of last year, which killed 1,200 people and then precipitated, very predictably, Israel's devastating response in Gaza, that the plan was for there to be a multi-front war against Israel, and that multi-front war has now collapsed, really. It is just Israel against Hamas in Gaza. Iran has stepped back, Hezbollah has stepped back. That's why I say to you, aren't you on your own here?
First of all, I have to correct something. Our action on October 7th, it's an act of defense based on 67 years of occupation, based on 17 years of siege on Gaza. Thousands of Palestinians along their last 20 years were killed and suffocated by the Israeli policies and aggressions. When it comes to the plans of Yahya Sinwar, yes, it's true. On the way to achieve our national goals, we are looking for the support of any other party outside Palestine. And I cannot agree that these multilateral fronts are collapsing because of a ceasefire in Lebanon.
And lots of Palestinians undoubtedly would agree that they hope that there be a resolution to the conflict, as indeed a lot of Israelis do and a lot of people around the world. In the meantime, the most immediate way in which the people of Gaza could gain some relief from the disaster that they are living through is for there to be a ceasefire. Hamas is one of two parties to those ceasefire negotiations. Israel, of course, is the other. Is it now not time to show a bit of flexibility just to bring some relief for the people of Gaza?
We were ready and we are still ready to implement the UN Security Council resolution, which is based on the Israeli paper, to reach a ceasefire.
Why do you think it is in that case that Qatar, the long-time mediator between Israel and Hamas, said that it was withdrawing from its mediation role because, and I quote, both sides are not showing a willingness to negotiate? It wasn't just about the Israelis. It was also about Hamas.
Look, I can understand the huge pressure exercised on the Qataris to pressure Hamas to yield to the Israeli pressures by massacring the civilians, by assassinating our leadership. But we are ready to implement the broker deal. And the Qataris and the Egyptians know this. The only one who is sabotaging each time we were near to reach a ceasefire agreement was Benjamin Netanyahu.
Isn't there another reading of this, which is that Hamas, or certain figures, certain hardline, even harder line figures in Hamas, want this war to carry on because you think that it will further isolate Israel, and actually the suffering of people in Gaza is an instrumental part of that?
Look, first of all, Hamas is a big institutionalized decision-making group. Second, those people you are talking about are my own people. My family is living in Gaza. And therefore, I cannot expect that someone like me or any other leader in Hamas is ready to sacrifice his own people in order to show the world how brutal is Israel.
Hamas's Bassam Naim speaking to Tim Franks and ending this edition of NewsHour.